This is episode 216 of the Solomonster Sounds Off on sescoops.com. It is Saturday, April 28th, 2012. I am the Solomonster. A hearty welcome to all of our new listeners out there. I know we have at least a few here this week tuning into the Sound Off for the very first time, so welcome. Got a couple of house cleaning bits here to get out of the way at the beginning. The first thing I want to mention here this week, and we're going to get into Extreme Rules, which is coming up, of course, tomorrow night on pay-per-view as I record this. A three-hour Raw from Detroit Rock City this past Monday night. We'll talk about that and a bunch of other things as well. But first, I want to give a shout-out to Rick from the Netherlands, who actually sent me an email this morning alerting me that Kofi Kingston's WrestleMania 28 video diary has now been posted up on the WWE channel on YouTube. You could probably find it at WWE.com. You could also find a link to it on my Twitter and Facebook, at Solomonster on Twitter, Facebook.com/TheSolomonster. You can friend me on there for access. A video that Kofi recorded during his time in Miami for WrestleMania weekend. Why it only went up now, a month later, I have no idea. But it actually jogged my memory because when we interviewed Kofi at Access that Friday down in Miami, he was filming for his diary, his video diary. And I had completely forgotten about it, and Rick sent me an email this morning alerting me that it is up. And there is, in fact, a Solomonster sighting in this video from when we were seated at the table doing our interview with him at Access. If you sneeze or you blink, you might miss it, but if you want to see the video and the quick Solomonster cameo in it, it's about 3.5 minutes in or so. You can check out the video. It's online on my Twitter and my Facebook. So thank you to Rick for that, because in all honesty, if Rick didn't mention it to me, I probably would have missed the whole damn thing. So with that out of the way, I have a little announcement to make here at the beginning of the show. I mentioned on Twitter a few days ago that I would have a special announcement. And the announcement has to do with something that's happening on the website this Monday. Now, many of you are aware that back in the day, I co-hosted a show right here on SEScoops.com with my buddy Noah Mark. It was a little show called SEScoops Live. And we did close to, if not about 40, I think, live shows from 2008 straight through until either last year or the year before. We had done it was the last time I think we did a show. We did, of course, the roundtable sound off down in Miami at WrestleMania. That was a lot of fun with Noah and with Brian Blade. But what we're doing is we're going to be bringing back SE Scoops Live, a very special edition of SE Scoops Live, for at least one night only. I don't want to get ahead of myself and say that it's back for good. The idea is that we would do one once a month right before Raw. Now, traditionally, when we did the show in the past, it would be immediately after Raw, which is just too late for me. So what we're doing this time is at 8 p.m. Eastern Time this Monday night, 1 hour before Raw begins on the USA Network, we being myself and Noah Mark, will be going live on SEScoops.com via Blog Talk Radio, of course, just like the old days, which means brace yourself for potential technical issues. I'm just letting you know ahead of time. But it is an 8 p.m. start. We'll be co-hosting SEScoops Live 1 hour before Raw this Monday night. You can go on SEScoops.com at that time. There'll be a post somewhere on the top of the website. You click in there, and all the instructions will be in there. We'll be talking about Extreme Rules from the night before, going over the results of the pay-per-view. We'll talk about Raw and give a quick Raw preview for the night. And we also will be taking listener calls. So there will be a phone number that will be posted. The best thing to do is follow me on Twitter and or friend me on Facebook, because during the course of the day on Monday, I will let everybody know the details as far as what number to call in and what the link is to the stream, all that stuff. So that is the plan. We'll take calls, we'll talk Extreme Rules, we'll talk Raw, and as soon as we're done yakking, Raw will go on the air and we will go off. So that is the plan for this Monday, April 30th. SE Scoops Live is back. You can tune in. Myself and Noah Mark will be on the air. Should be a lot of fun. The idea, we might shoot to do this once a month, the night after a pay-per-view, 1 hour before Raw, but for at least the time being, this is a little experiment. So for those of you who were never part of the old live shows, they were a lot of fun. We got some really good calls. There was some good banter back and forth, so I'm sure there'll be much of the same this time around. So won't you join us, SC Scoops Live, back in business this Monday night on SCScoops.com beginning at 8 p.m. So I wanted to mention that here. Sunday night is the Extreme Rules pay-per-view from Chicago. You may as well call this the WrestleMania Revenge Show, since it features a total of 4 rematches from earlier this month's WrestleMania 28 in Miami. But the combination of Brock Lesnar's first match back in 8 years and no doubt a hot Chicago crowd for the Punk Street fight have convinced me to part with my hard-earned dollars this month and order the show. So I'm looking forward to it. Let me give a quick rundown of the pay-per-view lineup, of course, the main event. And you could argue exactly what the main event is. You can argue that being that it is Chicago and CM Punk is the WWE champion, that he should be in the main event. Perhaps the street fight with Punk and Chris Jericho should go on last. You could certainly make that argument. I don't think it will. But we have Punk and Jericho in a street fight for the WWE championship. And anytime you take two guys like Punk and Jericho, put them in the ring, I think you're pretty much bound for a good match. They had a pretty damn good match at WrestleMania earlier in the month. And now you have the street fight stipulation in there. Now, I have not been a big fan of this storyline, the way they have positioned it as Punk coming out every week and, you know, talking about how he's straight edge, he doesn't drink, he doesn't do drugs, which is great. That's a great message to send. But Jericho coming out and talking about his mother and how, you know, his sister's a drug addict and his father's a drunk and this and that. It was okay at first, and now I'm kind of over the whole thing. And I was not a fan of the BS with the sobriety test and all the bull crap from Raw Monday Night, which we'll get into in a little bit. You just take these two guys, put them in a ring, and let them do what they do best. You know, they go out there and they have some kick-ass matches. And I think on Sunday night, the street fight stipulation, it's going to be a hell of a match. I think it could steal the show. And I personally think that CM Punk is retaining the championship. I don't think they're going to do a title change. I thought, if anything, they'd do the title change at WrestleMania, come back in Chicago, Punk's hometown, for this show, and have him win the belt back. But they didn't go in that direction. So I think Punk leaves Chicago still with the championship. And that's my prediction for the title match. Should be fun. Brock Lesnar and John Cena is the real main event on this show. It is an Extreme Rules match, apropos for a pay-per-view called Extreme Rules. That it is kind of funny that that is the lasting legacy of the original ECW, this whole Extreme Rules thing. You know, the original ECW was so much more than just, you know, hardcore matches and weapons and stuff. And yet, thanks to WWE, that will be the everlasting legacy of ECW, is this whole concept of Extreme Rules matches. So you've got Brock Lesnar, you've got John Cena. This is Brock Lesnar's first match back in a WWE ring since 2004. His last match was against Bill Goldberg in Madison Square Garden at WrestleMania 20. What kind of shape is Brock Lesnar going to be in? Nobody seems to know. I think he'll be in tremendous shape, all things considered. Keep in mind, here's a guy who went through some pretty major health issues. You know, he had the diverticulitis, he had up to a foot of his colon removed, pretty major surgery not too long ago, that ultimately ended his fighting career. Now, you know, you can make the argument, well, that's fighting, this is wrestling, and that's real, this is fake, so I'm sure he'll be fine. You know, the rigors of being in the ring in pro wrestling aren't all that much different than other sports. You still, you know, your body takes a beating, it takes its toll on you. The Brock Lesnar I remember from many years ago was this, I mean, a massively frightening individual who would go in there and beat the hell out of people. And what made him so frightening to me was the fact that here's a guy who's, what, 6'4", you figure? At the time, he had to be a good 280. I mean, he was a monster of a man, but he moved with the agility and the speed of a cruiserweight. You know, his speed is what always made him a scary figure to me, because you're not used to seeing a guy that big move around the way that Brock Lesnar used to. Now, Brock Lesnar is nowhere near as big, physically big, as he once was, but he's still a big dude, and he's still a scary dude. He can still move around. He's not an old man, you know, now he's in his mid-30s now. What will he look like? I think that's one of the big questions going into the pay-per-view. I'm very anxious to see what Brock Lesnar, the pro wrestler, looks like in the ring this Sunday night. Now, he goes up against John Cena, and there's been a lot of debate about, you know, would WWE actually have the gall in Brock's first match back, a man, mind you, that they are paying, as rumors suggest, as much as $5 million for a 1-year contract. Would they take their $5 million man and in his first match back, make him lose to John Cena. The only way I see that happening is if it's some sort of fluky win, where Cena gets some sort of a roll-up or a small package or some... Or something along the lines of a disqualification, although I guess in an Extreme Rules match there are no DQs, so that would be the only way I would envision John Cena winning. You know, the thought of John Cena pinning Brock Lesnar clean 1-2-3 or making him submit, even worse, I just cannot fathom that WWE is that stupid but to make that decision at the pay-per-view. So I'm picking Brock Lesnar in this match. It should be no surprise. I am worried. I am worried about what they have in store, but I think at the end of the day, Brock Lesnar gets the win, as he should, his first match back. They've got a lot riding on this guy. He's a big investment going into next year's WrestleMania. I'm not saying you keep him undefeated between now and then, necessarily, but his first match back, he should win. And he should win decisively. I don't think he should win because Laurinaitis interferes, because John Cena is distracted. I mean, I could very easily see WWE going in that direction. We know this feud between Cena and Laurinaitis has been built up now, and for him to be involved would not shock me at all. Although if David Otunga rears his face in that main event, I will throw furniture in the house here, because David Otunga has no business being a part of this match at all on Sunday. It should be one-on-one, Lesnar versus Cena. I am okay with John Cena getting offense in there. I am okay with having them in there for 10-12 minutes in a somewhat competitive match. I don't think John Cena should just roll over and die, but the way that I would envision this going is that you've got these two bulls in there, and you know, Cena has a lot of trouble containing Brock, and Brock is throwing him around, and Brock is showing his dominance, and then you give Cena some offense. But at the end of the day, Brock Lesnar should win this match clean in the middle of the ring, 1-2-3. That's how this match should end. And as far as what happens, you know, will they possibly do an injury angle where Brock takes out Cena? Cena can take some time away from television. To me, I think that would be the ideal, just because if anybody on the roster could benefit from being freshened up, if anybody on the roster could benefit from having some time away, it's John Cena. John Cena has always been around. The only time he ever takes off is when he's hurt. And even when he's hurt, he's not gone all that long. They did the storyline a year or two ago where he got fired, and which was comical because I don't think he missed a single TV show, even though he was, quote, fired. This is a company that is absolutely terrified to take this guy off TV because, you know, he's their main guy. And without him, they worry about ratings, they worry about tickets, they worry about merchandise, they worry about all that stuff. I think sometimes you have to take a short-term hit for long-term gain. I think the best thing to do would be to take Cena out of the picture for at least 2 months. I'm not saying 6 months, but a good 2 months. You can feed somebody else to Brock Lesnar in the meantime as he, you know, barrels through some other guys on the roster. I don't even know that you want Brock Lesnar fighting at every pay-per-view. You've only got him for a certain number of dates. You know, you want the guy to feel special. You've already got him wrestling at Extreme Rules. Does he really need to be wrestling, for example, at Over the Limit, some random show in May? I don't think so. So you can get away with keeping Cena off TV and letting Brock, with his, you know, minimal number of appearances, doing something else. I think the way to go is to have Brock win decisively and then take out Cena and do some sort of injury angle and just make Brock look like an absolute monster. That's how this should go down. Is it going to happen that way? Probably not. But as long as Brock Lesnar wins this match, to me, that is the only decision that you can make here. That is the only outcome of this match that makes any real sense. You can have Cena beat Brock, and then Brock gets all pissed off and then murders Cena, but then you're still left with Brock Lesnar, a loser, in his first match, and I just wouldn't do that. We have the World Heavyweight Championship on the line as well. It will be a 2-out-of-3-falls match. Sheamus defending against Daniel Bryan. I do not expect Sheamus to lose the championship in this match, even though I would love to see Bryan back with the World Heavyweight title. I think he's probably more over now than he was before WrestleMania. And I'm not going to give WWE credit looking back like, oh, you see, WWE had him lose in 18 seconds at WrestleMania. That was a good thing. WWE was not expecting people to take to Daniel Bryan with the yes chants and all that at the arenas the way that they did. That's not how they planned it. It just sort of happened. It was an organic thing. One of those things you can't really predict, but you kind of run with, even though WWE is trying to run away from it. Second week in a row, the awful job they did of dubbing out the cheers and the yes chants on SmackDown and dubbing in those fake crowd jeers for Bryan is just completely ridiculous. But So I'm not going to give them credit for that. It just sort of happened. And if I'm WWE, I embrace it. Whether that means turning him babyface, it might be a little early for that. But Bryan is probably one of the most over guys in the entire company right now. Do you take the title off Sheamus a month after, not even a month really, after he won it? Well, I don't think they will. So let's just leave it at that. I think Sheamus retains, and that's fine. As long as they give these two guys enough time to go in there and have a kick-ass match. You know, you did the 18-second deal at WrestleMania. You wanted to try something different. You wanted to set some sort of record. Fine. Now, a month later, it doesn't matter. Let these two guys go in there. It's 2 out of 3 falls. I would imagine this match is going to have some length to it. And I think they could have a great match. So that's really what I'm looking forward to more than anything else. You know, regardless of the outcome here, because whatever the outcome is won't offend me. If Sheamus retains, I predict that Sheamus will retain. I'd be fine with that. If Bryan wins the championship, great. In this case, I'm just going to kick back and enjoy, hopefully, a great match between two guys that I think work pretty well together. So that's my prediction for the World Heavyweight title match. Randy Orton will have another WrestleMania rematch here with Kane. This time, Falls Count Anywhere. I could not possibly care any less about this feud. It was just a filler match at WrestleMania that is just being dragged out because, again, they just don't have anything for these two guys right now. I hope this is the culmination of this feud between the two of them, and if it is, then I would expect Randy Orton to finally go over. I cannot imagine that Kane will cleanly defeat Randy Orton 2 pay-per-views in a row unless they want to come back for a third match, and that's the blow-off. Hopefully this is the blow-off. This is it. This is the end. And if it is, you can only go with one person, Randy Orton. So he's my pick for that match. Big Show and Cody Rhodes will have another WrestleMania rematch. Intercontinental Championship on the line. And this time, WWE.com has announced that the stipulation for this match will be determined via the Raw Roulette Wheel. So they're going to spin the wheel to determine what the stipulation is for this match. They'll do so at the pay-per-view. I'm not sure if it's on the pay-per-view itself or the pre-show on YouTube. But we will know on Sunday night what the stip is for this match. I'm going to go with Cody Rhodes here. I don't see what's gained by keeping the Intercontinental title on the Big Show long term. I just don't trust them enough to want to make the IC title mean anything. You can keep the title on Big Show for a couple of months and make it mean something, but they don't care about making the championship mean anything. So I think Cody Rhodes would benefit more by having it back. I don't see what is gained by having Big Show embarrass him 2 months in a row. Whatever the stipulation is, I assume it will probably work to Cody's advantage, and I think he'll walk away with the championship. So I'm predicting a title change here. Cody Rhodes gets the IC title back and hopefully moves on to better things because Cody was doing pretty well for himself, and his momentum has just completely stalled, dead in its tracks. Hopefully Extreme Rules will change that. There is a pre-show match. WWE announced on Monday night that they will be airing for the first time a pre-show on YouTube, and it will be for the United States Championship, The Miz challenging Santino Marella for the title. I will go out on a limb here and predict that Miz will win the U.S. title, a title that he has held before. I think at some point Miz can't possibly go any lower than he already is. And you could already tell he's gotten some victories. WrestleMania, I think he won the match for his team, unless I'm completely misremembering that. He's gotten some other wins recently. I think he beat Alex Riley on Superstars, and it looks like the tides are turning in Miz's favor because, again, how much further down the ladder could this guy go? So I think he's on an upswing and would not shock me at all for him to win the title. I will predict a Miz U.S. title win. And really, what better way to make the YouTube pre-show for the first time that you're doing it feel special than having a title change? So I'm going to go with a new U.S. champion in that match. One match I missed, actually, that's on the pay-per-view is the Divas Championship. It will be Beth Phoenix getting a rematch against Nikki Bella, who beat her on Monday night to become the new Divas Champion. Beth will get her rematch at the pay-per-view. And all I will say is that it was a year ago at this very same event, Extreme Rules, that someone made her very impactful debut in WWE. And I would not be at all surprised to see her return on the same show this year. In fact, I'm not even convinced that Beth will be able to wrestle here, which may pave the way perhaps for somebody else to take her spot and win the title, and what I still think is probably going to be the Bella's final appearance on WWE TV. As far as I know, anyway, Nikki and Brie are gone as of Monday. I believe their contract is officially up. I don't believe they've re-signed. So we'll see what happens. And you know, as far as Beth goes, what I mean by not being sure if she'll wrestle, I could see them doing an angle because they did the injury angle with her ankle on Raw Monday night, which was very well done. And I could see a situation where perhaps she comes out or doesn't even come out. Perhaps she's attacked backstage and then the Bellas come out and they do this deal where, you know, come on, count her out. She's not coming out. I win by forfeit. And instead, Laurinaitis or somebody comes out and out comes Karma. Karma being the person I was referring to before. Karma has been off television now for quite some time and has had some personal issues recently that she's dealt with. She was the one who made her debut on the show last year, and I could see her being brought out to be the newly anointed challenger for Nikki Bella's championship. So that's one way that they could potentially go with it. As far as a prediction, I'm not even going to bother making a prediction here. I predict that we will have a new champion. It may not be Beth Phoenix, but I do predict that we will have a new champion on Sunday night. So that is the rundown for Extreme Rules coming up Sunday on pay-per-view. Again, myself and Noah will be on the air live at scscoops.com 8 p.m. on Monday night before Raw to talk about the fallout from Extreme Rules before Raw hits the airwaves. And speaking of Raw, why don't we talk about Raw from this past Monday night? It was a three-hour go-home show from Detroit, Michigan. And thankfully, I was already planning to buy the pay-per-view, as I mentioned before, because this show on Monday did nothing. Nothing to make me want to spend money on Extreme Rules. It didn't make me not want to buy the show, but if I were somebody on the fence about it, I would probably still be tied to that fence right about now. We did get to see highlights, though, of Brock Lesnar taking out most of the TNA roster. They had clips of his wins from years ago over Jeff Hardy and Hulk Hogan, his WrestleMania 19 win over Kurt Angle, minus the botched Shooting Star Press, which they omitted. For those of you wondering if that was all just a coincidence, them showing the clips of Brock killing all the TNA people, just consider this. They did not have segments on Raw featuring clips of his SummerSlam win over The Rock, or Brock beating Undertaker, or Brock hoisting Big Show up for the F5, or any of those currently active, quote, active WWE guys. They didn't show any of that. So what does that tell you? This show was also 3 hours long. I mentioned that. My problem with this show probably had more to do with the fact that it was so long. Maybe I'm being a little hard on it. I know some of you liked it, but to me, when Raw is 3 hours, unless you have a gimmick, you know, years ago they did the King of the Ring tournament, and I'm a King of the Ring fan. So they went and they did the King of the Ring, and they completely pissed me off because it was a complete joke. That was the year that Regal won the tournament. They had him against Hornswoggle the Midget in the opening round, and the matches were like 2 minutes long. And to me, what's the point of doing a tournament if you're just going to rush the whole damn thing and it's going to be a complete joke? So that actually PO'd me more than anything else. There was no gimmick. There was there was no plan for this show. It was just a regular 3 hour edition of Raw. And I think for that reason, it just made the show drag so much that by the middle of the third hour, I was already ready to tap out. I was done. I was finished. I mean, Nitro going 3 hours back in the day helped speed up the demise of WCW. And that was when wrestling was much hotter than it is today. You know, I know it's only a couple of times a year they do this, but unless they really have something special planned, they should not be doing these three-hour shows. And in fairness, it's not WWE's fault, really. It's USA that tells Vince McMahon, hey, listen, you know, we want you to do a three-hour Raw on this day. We want you to do a three-hour Raw on that day. It's not necessarily WWE's choice to do this, so I'm not blaming them specifically for the fact that this is happening. I just don't think we should be getting these three-hour Raws unless you have something you can fill those 3 hours with. And because of that, I just thought that this show was not a very good show. There were, you know, glimmers of good things on the show, but for the most part, I just sat there bored, and I just didn't think anything was really all that special. I do have to say this, though. I do have to say that the work of the wrestlers on the show had absolutely nothing to do with me feeling that way. You know, these guys had just wrapped up their grueling tour of Europe before returning stateside to Detroit to do the show on Monday night. And I can only imagine, I can't even imagine how exhausted they were probably, you know, they probably were when they came in for this show. So I don't want to make it sound like I'm hating on them, not at all. They have my utmost respect. I mean, God, the way you look at the schedule they have when they're over there, and they're in, you know, Berlin, and they go from Berlin to Ireland to France to all these different places, and then they come back to the States, and they have to do the usual round of TVs. It's not an easy thing to do. I'm sure a lot of guys were tired. They were beat up. They were, you know, maybe a little sloppy, whatever the case may be. By no means am I hating on them for that. I just didn't think this was a very good show. It opened up with a contract signing, or what was supposed to be a contract signing for the pay-per-view, Brock Lesnar and John Cena. It did not happen, thankfully. If it did happen, it would have been ridiculously idiotic, given that they didn't bother promoting this little fact on TV the week before. I mean, they announced that Lesnar and Cena would have a contract signing, but they never said that on this three-hour show, Lesnar and Cena would open the show. To me, that was the main event segment. You didn't bother telling anybody until 4 hours before on the website that you were going to open the show at 8 o'clock. It just would have been completely foolish for them to put this on, and thankfully they didn't, because no matter how hard they try, the first hour of these three-hour shows always does a much smaller rating than the traditional 2 hours. So why start with your main event segment? That was my argument, and I think they realized this, because it was just a tease to set up later in the show the contract signing. Laurinaitis came out, told Cena that Brock was not yet at the building. I did laugh when Teddy Long introduced John Cena as a 2-time WWE champion and a 10-time WWE champion. Oh, boy. But you know what? Who can really blame the guy? I mean, I'm sure even he thinks it's stupid to have two world titles. And this clip, by the way, of Teddy's little announcing botch was funny enough that it made the soup on E! This week. So a lot of people, unfortunately, had a nice chuckle at Teddy Long's expense. Edge made a surprise appearance in this segment. I was not expecting it. He was actually flown into the show to meet with WWE about a potential contract extension. His current deal is up next week. He supposedly had been reluctant to sign a new one because, as the stories suggest, the offers that WWE were making him up to this point have been somewhat insulting to him in terms of money. It was not like some of the deals they have with some of the bigger guys, like, say, a Steve Austin or a Shawn Michaels. So he has been reluctant to sign. And I'm still not sure if he has or not. I haven't heard one way or the other. But he was in the building. He was there in Detroit. So they decided to script him into the opening segment with Cena, being that he was going to be there anyway. He came out, Edge did, said that this was not the same John Cena that put Edge through two tables in a TLC match and threw him into the Long Island Sound. He called Cena his greatest rival, which I guess you can make the case for. He said that him and Cena actually care about wrestling, whereas Brock Lesnar does not. He says it's time for Cena to wake up and stand up for everybody who loves this business. He wasn't asking Cena to beat Lesnar. He was telling him. And just like that, he left and was never seen again for the rest of the show. And Cena just stood there looking like he was about to cry. Well, at least he wasn't smiling. So that was your opening segment right there. A little bizarre, but it was nice to see Edge come out. The crowd was certainly caught off guard by that. A nice little surprise. First match of the night was Chris Jericho and Kofi Kingston. And I've seen people online saying, oh, well, you know, this match was not that great. It, you know, botching moves, and they were a little, you know, sloppy or whatever. That may well have been the case. If it was, I didn't pick up on it. I thought they had the best match on the entire show. I've heard that Jericho and Kofi have had some really kick-ass matches at the house show, so when they came out for this one, I was very excited. And it was pretty good. Pretty good match between Jericho and Kofi. Jericho beat him clean, as he should have, being that Jericho was the number one contender for the title. He beats Kofi in the end with the Walls of Jericho submission. And after the match, Jericho said that he will be taking Punk's title. And again, he insulted Punk's family. And that was that. Backstage, we had Laurinaitis offering Eve Torres a job in his administration as the executive administrator. And Eve accepted this offer, and that was pretty much all there was to that. Now, on the show, this is the recurring storyline that they had throughout the show that I said before I was not a big fan of. They had this first segment where Punk showed Josh Matthews a liquor basket that Chris Jericho had sent him as a gift. And Punk gave the basket to Josh, but he kept a bottle of, I think it was Jack Daniels, which is the same bottle that Jericho cracked over his head a couple of weeks ago. And throughout the show, you know, there were segments later on, Jericho bumped into Alex Riley, of all people. I can't even remember. I guess the last time Alex Riley was on Raw, he got crushed by Lord Tensai. But before that, he has been persona non grata on Raw. Alex Riley has been Superstar's job bait now for so long. But there he was, backstage, and Jericho bumps into him, and Alex Riley is telling him, you know, I saw CM Punk drinking backstage from the gift basket. And Jericho thinks this might be a setup. He says, let's go. You come with me. And they go to the locker room and peek in. And sure enough, Jericho sees Punk drinking out of a cup with the bottle of liquor right next to him. And from this, he obviously figures that Punk is drinking. He has become a He has become what Jericho said he would become. He has followed in the footsteps of his drunken alcoholic father, and he has become a drinker himself. And so they had the, eventually they had the whole sobriety test in the middle of the ring. They had these fake rent-a-cops in there, and they had Punk try to recite the alphabet backwards, and he tried to walk in a straight line. I have to say, I've seen people pretend to be drunk before. I myself have pretended to be drunk. Sometimes, you know, you're out, and, you know, people are being pretty much stupid and obnoxious, and they're either really batshit drunk or whatever the case may be. And I myself have on occasion pretended to be drunk just to go along with the gag. And I have never seen a worse performance of somebody pretending to be drunk in my entire life. I mean, Punk was terrible at this, which is good because it proves that Punk really doesn't know what the hell it feels like to be drunk. And that's a good thing. You know, he is straight edge after all. But he did a pretty piss poor job, I think, of pretending to be drunk. I thought for sure when Punk came down and, you know, he does this thing where he climbs the turnbuckles in the corner and raises the title belt up in the air. I thought for sure, you know, if you're pretending to be drunk, when he goes to raise his arms in the air, he'll probably lose his balance and fall, and he'll fall into the ring. And nope, he held the belt up and climbed into the ring and otherwise looked perfectly fine. He looked tired, is what he looked like. He looked like he rolled out of bed. He didn't look like he was drunk. So that kind of hurt the whole thing. And I know I'm skipping ahead here, but just to skip ahead to that segment, I just thought it was a complete waste of time. I thought maybe if they shaved a good 5 or 6 minutes off, it wouldn't have been so bad. But this thing just kept going on and on. And I mean, I guess the fans seemed to kind of sort of be into it. I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know what the people in Detroit felt about this particular segment. But I just this didn't work for me. It just didn't work for me. And one of the reasons it didn't work for me is you have built this feud up to be such a personal issue between Punk and Jericho, where Jericho comes out week after week and insults this man's family. He spreads lies and rumors about the guy's father. He insults the guy's sister. He insults the guy's mother. You know, he calls him a bastard. He says, you know, this person's a drug addict. You're going to turn out to be just like them. Smashes a liquor bottle across his head. All of these vile things that Chris Jericho has done, bringing Punk's family into it. And Punk is in the ring with Chris Jericho. He is just mere inches away from this man. And instead of attacking him and taking out all of his anger and frustrations on Jericho, because it's not like there was a zero tolerance, you can't touch me policy. We've seen that on TV before. No! Instead of doing that, Punk just elects to stand there and pretend to be drunk, just so in the end he can, you know, pull the wool over everybody's eyes. All I could think while he was standing there is, why aren't you beating the hell out of this guy? Why aren't you kicking his ass? After everything this guy has done, I'd be tearing this guy limb from limb right now, and all Punk can do is stand there and act. And I just thought that was really stupid. If you're going to put those two guys that close to each other, they got to get physical. There's got to be a big pull apart. Punk has to just snap and go absolutely crazy to sell this street fight on Sunday. And I thought, this is not the way to build your WWE Championship match. And some people were entertained by it. There's a time to be entertained by segments like this, and there's a time on a go-home show 6 days before the pay-per-view that you're trying to convince people to pay $45 for. There's a time to kind of say, you know what, it's not so important that we entertain them in this segment and make them laugh. It's more important to sell them on the match. And I just didn't think they did a very good job of that here. So that's my thoughts on the whole Punk Jericho thing, just to skip around here. I thought this was a big step back this week. Just not a fan of what they did. Lord Tensai had a match on this show against R-Truth. It was another squash. This is just not working. I like The Mist. And I like Albert, too. You know, but he just... This character just isn't working. I don't know if it's the fact that it feels so dated. It feels like one of these 80s cartoon characters you would see in the old WWF. I mean, so it may, you know what? Maybe there is something to that. Because the Umaga character, I thought, was completely ridiculous. The Umaga character was classic 80s WWF. And I remember when Umaga debuted, it just felt out of place. And then when they picked Umaga to be part of that whole Battle of the Billionaires thing with Vince McMahon and Donald Trump at WrestleMania a couple of years ago, I thought to myself, of all the people to pick for an angle like this that is going to get mainstream publicity with Donald Trump and all this, you pick Umaga? People are going to look at this and they're going to laugh. So maybe with Tensai, it's a little bit of the same thing. You know, he's got the Hakushi characters, the fake tattoos on his head, and I think the presentation is kind of nice. You know, the get-up and Sakamoto as his they don't like to use the word managers. Managers is still a dirty word in WWE. So instead of managers, I think they said Sakamoto is like a follower, and you know, Abraham Washington is an agent. I don't care what they call them. I like the fact that we have managers back. So I like that aspect, but people just don't seem to give a shit about Lord Tensai. They just don't. There's no reaction. They chant Albert at the guy. This just isn't working. I don't know what you do. Do you give it some more time to work? You know, the guy beat John Cena the week before, and all of a sudden he comes out this week, and you would never know that he beat the biggest star in the company 7 days earlier. He just came out for another squash. The people didn't react, and it's just not working. It's not working for me. Kane came out. I completely tuned this whole thing out. I love Kane. I got nothing against Kane, but when he comes out for these monologues and these speeches, it's just boring. Oh my God. It's so over the top and so hokey. It's like, you know, Shakespeare or something. It's like Kane is performing in a play and the damsel in distress is going to come out and just stop. Just stop with the stupid promos with Kane. This poor guy has been saddled with such horrible material now for so long. Just let him go out there and beat the hell out of people. Better yet, you know what? Put the old mask back on Kane so he doesn't even have to talk. Give Kane a manager. I mean, again, Kane can deliver his lines well. It's not so much an issue with Kane. It's an issue with the material. It sucks. So maybe you should put the old mask back on him and give him a mouthpiece. Maybe Abraham Washington can represent Kane. He can create this whole faction of all these people that, you know, either aren't getting over or have no business talking, and just let him do the talking for them. Anything is better than this. This is like Chinese waiter torture. It's just ridiculous. So Randy Orton is on the Titantron. Oh, this segment. So Orton, of course, his dad got beat up the week before on SmackDown by Kane. Cowboy Bob Orton was left laying. So naturally, eye for an eye, Randy Orton is up on the Titantron and says, "Hey, Kane, I got somebody here that you might know." And the camera pans out, and it's Paul Bearer. Paul Bearer, sitting in a wheelchair in a bad way. He's been beaten up, presumably by Randy Orton. We didn't see him get beaten up. But either he was beaten up, or Randy Orton just found Paul Bearer laying in the arena. Remember the last time we saw Paul Bearer? He was pushed off a platform and fell to, presumably, his death during the angle where Edge feuded with Kane and was torturing Kane by, you know, killing Paul Bearer every week and beating up his dad, and he kidnapped his father. And, you know, back then, Kane was beside himself. I mean, Kane, every single week, was trying to find out, you know, where Edge is and to get back Paul Bearer, and yet here in this segment, Kane didn't seem to give a shit about his father. In fact, he basically said that. He said he laughed when Randy Orton shoved Paul Bearer. He wheeled Paul Bearer into a giant meat locker, which for some reason there is a giant meat locker with lots of smoke and ice backstage at the, I guess it was the Joe Louis Arena, wherever they were in Detroit, and Kane could not care any less. He said, "Boy, you've misunderstood me. I don't care." Kill him! Who cares? All of a sudden, Kane, I guess, has had some sort of falling out with his father. So this whole thing was so stupid. This was so goddamn stupid, this whole segment, that, oh, God, it's just completely ridiculous. And at this point, Paul Bearer obviously is a comedy character. They will bring him back every now and then kill him off. You know, the first time he got killed, he was buried in some sort of cement grave by The Undertaker, and then I mentioned the thing with Edge where he was tossed off a platform while sitting in a wheelchair, and the camera showed him laying splattered all over the ground, and now he was shoved into a meat locker to freeze to death, unfortunately, this poor guy. So Kane ended the segment by saying that I'm a monster and you'll never wake up from me. Who gives a shit? Randy Orton, the idiot babyface, realized that his plan didn't work. You know, Kane didn't care to come backstage and save his father, so instead Randy Orton came out to the ring, and he had a brawl with Kane, and just, who cares? Who cares? I don't care about this feud. This is just a waste of time. Big Show and Great Khali had a match, yet again, second week in a row that Big Show and Khali had a match on Raw. I think they might have had one on SmackDown, too. And Khali had some sort of knee issues coming out of SmackDown from Friday night, so in this match, they beat Cody Rhodes and Alberto Del Rio. Khali was in there for a while. Big Show, I think, took most of the match. He was being beaten up in the ring, and I think he made the hot tag at one point to Khali, which was comical. In the end, Kali gave Cody the brain chop, choke slam from Big Show, and that was that. And, you know, Big Show and Kali, they look pretty awesome as a team when you look at them. You know, these two towering giants together as a team. And Kali seems like a really nice guy, guy that you could probably go out and, you know, he probably would love to party and have fun and a fun-loving guy. I don't need to see him in a match ever again. Because we're at the point now with Kali where it's bad enough that he can't wrestle. But I almost feel bad for the guy. He can barely move. I guess he was selling a knee injury on Monday night, but really, how much of that was a sell job? That's just how he walks. The guy can barely walk. So if you want to keep him on the roster, and I will say this. If I were in charge of WWE, and I had to make some really tough decisions, it's really easy to sit here and people all the time, they say, well, you know, if I were in WWE, I would cut this guy, and I would cut that guy, and I would cut this guy. Let me tell you something. When I was down in Miami for WrestleMania last month, I got to meet a lot of these guys, and they were really super cool. You know, I can't really speak ill of anybody personally that I met or any of the people that we got to interview. I think we interviewed people who were very laid back, very cool, very down to earth. And I got to kind of see them interact, and a lot of people in that company are very friendly with each other. And from what I understand, a lot of people are very friendly with Kali. They love having him around. He's a good guy. It's a lot easier for you to sit there, for a person to sit behind their computer and say, well, I'm going to fire this person if I'm in charge. And I'm going to get rid of this person. I'm going to get rid of half the roster if I'm in charge. It's not quite that easy. You know, if I were in charge of WWE, I don't think I would be getting rid of Kali right away. I think I would have to take a lot of different factors into consideration, including how he is perceived in the locker room. And maybe I would find something else for him to do. But if you put a gun to my head and said, listen, Salamaster, you are now in charge of the WWE roster. We've got to cut costs. We've got to trim the fat. You need to make a list of X number of people to get rid of. Great Khali is going to be pretty much at the top of my list. I just don't see there being any value in him being part of the active roster anymore. You can put him in a comedy segment, but all the value that you could possibly get from him, you've already extracted from him a long time ago. You put the world title on this guy. Think about that. Great Khali, world heavyweight champion. Something that Dave Bautista once said in an interview made him physically sick to even fathom the idea that Khali was a world champion. You know, they put Kali in matches with everybody from Shawn Michaels to Triple H, John Cena. You know, he's matched up with pretty much everybody. Undertaker, Big Show, Kane. What more can you do with this guy? Why is he out there on my television? He shouldn't be. He shouldn't be. They had Brock Lesnar finally arriving at the building. Josh Matthews tried to interview him, mistake number one. Brock looked at him, but did not harm him. And if I'm Josh Matthews at that point, I drop down to my knees, clasp my hands together, and thank the Lord above that this guy didn't take my head off, and I move on with my day. But nope, Josh Matthews was persistent, and Lesnar went to walk away, and Josh should have been thankful to get away with his life, and instead he muttered to himself, well, I'm just trying to do my job. I'm just trying to do my job. Well, that was all Brock Lesnar needed to hear. He grabbed Josh Matthews and violently threw him into the set backstage where they interview the wrestlers. It was the mesh fencing. And when you really look at it, he didn't really do that much to him. But they did the whole stretcher job for Josh Matthews. I mean, it was comical. They had him, you know, taped to the backboard. At one point, I heard somebody, one of the medical workers, say something about, you know, can he move his limbs or something like that. It reminded me of when they did the angle where Kevin Nash backstage attacked Triple H with a sledgehammer and left him laying. And the workers came over, and one of the first things they said was, you know, check his pulse. Does he have a pulse? You know, because Kevin Nash murdered his best friend. So now we have to check and make sure the guy has a pulse. It's just so stupid. So stupid. But I'm not gonna nitpick here. I thought this was great. Brock Lesnar is not a guy that wants to answer questions. In fact, I've said before, he hates doing media. And he just shows up at the building, and all of a sudden he's got a microphone shoved in his face. He should be beating the hell out of people like Josh Matthews. So that part of it I liked. I did like that. They had a Lumberjill match for the Divas Championship. Beth Phoenix, this is where she lost the title to Nikki Bella. They did an injury angle here that a lot of people didn't think was an angle at first. And that's a credit to Beth, because it was an angle, and it was just her doing a very good job of selling. Wouldn't you know, a pro wrestler is very good at their job. I love how people are, like, painting Beth Phoenix out to be the best of all time. Like, oh my God, that was so great. She's doing her job. You know, it's so seldom, I guess, these days that we actually take these things seriously, and people do a good job of selling injuries. But she, you know, I'll give her a lot of credit. She did a hell of a job. She probably did a better job than some of the top stars would in terms of selling this thing. And apparently backstage, she was hobbling around the airport the next morning when people saw her. They saw her, you know, I don't know if she was on crutches or anything, but she was also showing signs of being injured. She's fine. She's fine. But this was very well done. Nikki wins the championship, which shocked a lot of people because the news leaked that they were leaving the company. And again, I believe they are still leaving the company. And they're going to do something at the pay-per-view on Sunday night. So Nikki wins the title. And I see people also being very upset that a Bella twin won the title. I could have sworn that either Nikki or Brie already won the title at least once before. This is not the first time they put the championship on one of the Bellas. So I don't know why people are so bent out of shape about that. There's a match between Mark Henry and Sheamus. Daniel Bryan served as the special referee here and was probably more over than either guy in this match. Match didn't go very long. Bryan did what any heel referee would do. He fast-counted Sheamus after Mark Henry nailed him with a clothesline, and Mark Henry beat Sheamus in this non-title match. And Sheamus went to go after Daniel Bryan after the match. Didn't get him, but he did lay Henry out with a brogue kick. And Bryan got his revenge here, though. He did get Sheamus in the yes lock, and he left the champion laying. Perfectly fine way to promote a match between these two guys heading into the pay-per-view. See, this is how you do an angle on a go-home show to hype up a championship match, by having the challenger believably lay out the champion. That's how you do it, not have some sort of stupid you know, can you spell the alphabet backwards? Which, by the way, Punk apparently cannot do so even sober. He cannot. He botched the alphabet. But anyway. So this was fine. I like this a lot. Santino and Zack Ryder, something I didn't really like too much, beat Primo and Epico, tag team champions. 1, 2, 3. That was it. Santino actually beat the tag team champions with a Cobra. At least when Primo and Epico lost to Big Show and Kali, you know, these two guys that are literally at least twice their size, if not bigger, they got laid out. Okay, fine. I still thought that was incredibly dumb. But here, they got beaten by the Cobra. Tag team champions, everybody. Kane reappeared on my TV. I cried. He went by the meat locker, obviously showing that he did have some emotion left in his body for his father. He opened the meat locker and rolled out Paul Bear, who sadly did not have icicles hanging from his nose and eyelids. I think that would have made it funnier. If you're going to go for comedy, go all the way. But they didn't even do that. Paul Bear was shivering. He was shivering cold and was happy to see his son. And Kane ended up just rolling him right back into the meat locker and walking off. And that was that. That was the last we saw of Paul Bear. So nobody backstage in WWE apparently did anything to help this poor guy. No cameraman, none of the officials or referees or anybody in the back did anything to lift a finger to help Paul Bear. They just left him in there apparently until Kane took him out. And Kane put him right back in. So I guess we have to assume that Paul Bear is still sitting in that meat locker in Detroit because nobody let him out. A bunch of heartless, callous people backstage in WWE right here. Actually, I take that back. There was something on WWE.com about Paul Bear being treated for hypothermia. So at least somebody let the poor guy out. So I stand corrected. Somebody did rescue Paul Bear, but unfortunately it wasn't until he was already suffering the effects of hypothermia. So still a bunch of callous people backstage. We had Brodus Clay come out. He is now doing an act with Hornswoggle. I'm not quite sure how I feel about this. They beat Dolph Ziggler and Jack Swagger by disqualification in a match. It is incredibly frustrating for me to see Dolph Ziggler involved in this kind of stuff in any match, really, with Hornswoggle. In fact, Ziggler had to sell for Hornswoggle at one point. He did a, Horny did a spinning head scissors, I think it was. And it was just, it's just very sad. I hope that it's just them trying to come up with a better idea for Dolph and just not knowing what to do with him. In that case, I would just say, you know what? Ziggler's a pretty good talker. And when CM Punk was hurt with a hip injury way back when, if you'll recall, they decided they wanted to keep him on TV, and so they put him with the announcers. And Punk excelled. I mean, Punk was actually quite entertaining as an announcer on Raw, to the point where I was actually disappointed when he came back to wrestle. So why not do something with Dolph where he, you know, do an angle or something where he complains openly that WWE is not giving him any competition, they don't know what to do with the star of his caliber, and so therefore, to get himself on television every single week, he's going to sit right beside Jerry Lawler and Michael Cole and let Dolph go out there and show off his skills as an announcer for a couple of weeks until you come up with something better for the guy. Even that would be better than taking bumps for Hornswoggle, for Christ's sake. This was stupid. Contract signing was the main event on this show. At long last, Brock Lesnar came out, John Cena's music played, and he did not. John Cena was cowering in fear backstage somewhere at the thought of even going out there with Brock Lesnar. He probably saw the segment with Josh Matthews. I can't really blame John Cena for being scared. So then at that point, Brock Lesnar told John Laurinaitis that it's okay because I actually have some business to discuss with you. Have a seat. And this is where this segment fell off of a cliff. Absolutely fell off a cliff. How people could think that this segment was perfectly fine and did anything to really sell the match between Cena and Lesnar on Sunday. You see, on this show, they actually replayed that great Brock Lesnar video package, I think, 3 or 4 times. By the fourth time, even I was kind of getting tired of it. But that's what you have to do. You want as many people to see that video as possible because that video right there alone is going to sell pay-per-views. I still think that video is the best video of its kind that they've ever done. And it's going to sell a lot of buys for Extreme Rules. This contract signing? Not so much. The problem with this segment is, and I'm surprised some of you guys anyway didn't pick up on this, judging by the reaction on Facebook. I know some of you did. It was obvious to me that Brock Lesnar forgot his lines and lost track of what he was supposed to say. So we reached a point somewhere in this contract signing when Brock was constantly repeating himself. He was saying the same words over and over and over again. A telltale sign that somebody has clearly lost their train of thought. I felt bad for the guy. I was actually, you know, nobody is looking at me, but I'm covering my face out of embarrassment because I feel so badly for this guy out there. He was drowning. Drowning, and nobody in the crowd seemed to really give a shit either way about what he was saying. You know, because that's not how you build this feud up. It's not about talking. It's not about Brock Lesnar out there doing a whole 10-minute speech. That's exactly what Brock Lesnar should not be doing. Brock Lesnar should not be out there talking for too long. He should come out, he should say what he needs to say, threaten people, and then beat people up. That's what he should do. But this was just the typical WWE thing where, you know, let's give this guy some scripted dialogue, and that just goes on and on and on, and let's, you know, bring him down to everybody else's level and make him feel like everybody else. And I feel like that's what they did with Brock Lesnar here. They didn't destroy him or anything, but they didn't do with him what I certainly would have done with him on this show. If you're going to do a contract signing, that's fine. But have both guys come out, have both guys at the table staring at each other, and just have Brock stare a hole in Cena, because Brock Lesnar hates John Cena. He hates everything he stands for. He hates everything he represents. So Brock doesn't have to do his talking with his words. He could do his talking with his face, with his eyeballs, by just sitting there and staring at John Cena. That's all Brock has to do. And then the contract gets signed. Cena can talk, because that's all Cena ever does. And after the contract is signed, Brock slowly rises out of his chair and throws the chair aside and turns the table over and goes face-to-face, nose-to-nose in the middle of the ring with Cena. So now you've got a face-to-face Cena and Brock. People buzzing in the crowd. Now what you do at that point is certainly debatable. Do you have the guys get physical and go off the air with a brawl? Do you have the guys just, you know, stand there nose-to-nose and go off the air with the face-off? Do you have Brock then leave? I would have Brock leave. I mean, if you want Brock to be the heel, I can't think of a more heelish move than for Brock, the big, blustery, you know, former UFC fighter, to then back down from John Cena and leave with a smirk on his face. So Lesnar's the one smirking for a change instead of Cena. That's how I would have done this. And I'm willing to bet that WWE probably was not too thrilled with this either. I don't know one way or the other, but it just was very obvious to me that Brock lost his train of thought and just kept repeating himself, and he was just absolutely, completely lost out there. And, you know, you've got this fake contract sitting on the table. I can't imagine that, you know, WWE, it would be so easy for them to take the script for the show and lay it on the table. I mean, maybe the script was on the table and Brock still fucked up his lines. I don't know. But that was my first thought. And I was surprised they let this go on as long as it did before they finally played John Cena's music. I was actually ecstatic to hear John Cena's music because, to me, that was like Saved by the Bell right there for Brock Lesnar. How much longer could that guy have gone on for? He was out there making contract demands. That was basically the gist of what he was talking about. He said, I want, you know, Vince McMahon's corporate jet to land at the arena and take me to and from the buildings. I want more money, which is kind of funny. I had a lot of you guys write into me about the fact that I did the Brock Lesnar book review last week on Death Clutch and talked about how, you know, Brock is all about business and money is very important to him in the pay, in the big payday and all that. And so here's Brock on this show talking about how, even though you're already paying me millions of dollars, I want more money, which is probably a shoot. So that was kind of interesting. So that was basically what it was. He was making contract demands. Cena finally came out, and Cena had his old, you know, Doctor of Thugonomics chain and lock around his neck. I'm not sure what that means. I don't know if that means we're going to have rapper Cena on Sunday. I don't know. I thought it was kind of silly for just regular everyday John Cena to come out with a chain around his neck. Maybe that's what took him so long to come out. He was, you know, fishing around trying to look for it. But Cena looked scared. Cena, you know, he was not smiling. He was not cracking jokes. And that's the one thing I liked about this, is when Cena came out, he looked like a guy who was genuinely scared. And that's how you got to play this up, because Brock Lesnar is a guy who genuinely frightens people. And this is a challenge for Cena, the likes of which he's never had before. So he can't play this off as just any other guy. It's not him and The Rock going back and forth with jokes about, you know, Fruity Pebbles and you know, you look gay. No, you look gay. No, you look gay. You know, all that stupid, corny crap. This is the real deal here. You know, this is the biggest challenge he's ever had to face. Here's a guy who just came back from mixed martial arts threatening to kill John Cena. John Cena should be scared. He should be concerned. So I thought he played this off perfectly. And this, you know, the way this ended, it didn't end too badly. But Brock losing his train of thought and forgetting what he was supposed to say and just, you know, repeating himself over and over and over again was just very embarrassing. And it was almost difficult to watch. It was actually really difficult to watch. I mean, go back and watch that segment if you didn't pick up on it the first time. I thought it was pretty obvious that he was lost out there. So I'm not quite sure how anybody could come away from this contract signing thinking that it was a good segment that did a lot to sell, you know, the pay-per-view. They already sold me on it, but I can't imagine how that segment would have sold too many other people on that show on Sunday. So that was Raw. 3 hours of pretty mediocre stuff, I thought, from Monday night. And let's hope, well, actually, they are going to go 3 hours again on, I think, June 11th is the next three-hour Raw from Hartford. That's the next show where they're going to contemplate doing a draft, which hopefully they will change their minds about that, because it's just completely ridiculous to have a draft anyway, being that every week is Raw Super Show. Actually, one thing I forgot to mention, one of Brock's demands, which if they follow through on this, assuming he wins on Sunday, this would actually be kind of funny. One of his demands to John Laurinaitis, who, by the way, rubber-stamped everything. John Laurinaitis agreed to all of Lesnar's contract demands. So a hell of a GM this guy is. One of Lesnar's demands was that Raw from now on would not just be Monday Night Raw, but it would be Monday Night Raw starring Brock Lesnar. So if Raw on Monday night opens up with a new intro of nothing but Brock clips, or it opens up with the usual Raw intro, but then they have that neon kind of tube font lettering that lights up and says starring Brock Lesnar, I would actually kind of get a chuckle out of that. So we'll see. We'll see what they do. Although if Brock loses on Sunday, I'm not sure you can really do that. But hopefully that's an indication that Brock is going to win. And if they want to rename Raw, I'm perfectly fine with that. Just don't put Brock out there to cut long promos anymore, because that is not his strong suit. That's a situation where he would have benefited from having Paul Heyman out there again as his mouthpiece. But I can understand not, you know, Paul Heyman not being out there, though. Anybody who didn't really see much of Brock's UFC career and some of the promos he cut before his fights, Brock doesn't need Paul Heyman. If they let Brock just go out there, give him some bullet points and let him say it in his own style, he's come a long way from where he was 10 years ago in WWE. You know, Brock was one of the biggest pay-per-view draws of all time because of his mouth, because he can get people riled up. He can get people to hate his guts leading up to a fight. So it's kind of counterproductive, I would think, to just say, well, you know, just put Paul Heyman out there. Brock shouldn't even talk at all. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think Brock if put in the right situations, could be an awesome talker. I mean, just look at that video package. But this was not the right situation for him to be in at all. I only have one quick thing to mention here from SmackDown on Friday night, and that is that Claudio Castagnoli, who of course now is referred to as Antonio Cesaro in WWE, finally made his in-ring television debut. After all this time, all the years of working and then being in developmental and talking about, you know, oh, I can't wait until Claudio is up on the main roster, he finally made his television debut in the ring on Monday night, on Friday night, rather. He beat Tyson Kidd in a quick squash, and I was very excited to see him use his Swiss death move in this match. Everyone refers to it as Swiss death, and I will admit I actually wasn't even aware that that was the name he used for it. I had forgotten about all of that, but it's this great move where you come off the ropes and he kind of throws you up into the air, and as you come down he gives you a European uppercut. Just a really vicious looking move. And then he finished him off with his finisher, which actually he's going to have to change that finisher. It's I cannot see him using that on certain guys. Certain guys even allowing him to use it on them. It's not an overly devastating move. It just looks ridiculous to apply. So I'm sure he'll come up with a new finisher at some point. I wouldn't be opposed to him using Swiss Death as his finisher, quite frankly. But he beat Tyson Kidd pretty decisively. The backstory for Antonio here is that he is a former rugby player who had a bit of a mean streak. He had a bit of a short fuse, and I think they say he beat up officials or whatever. Look, this is WWE. You know, it's a classic. Let's give this guy a gimmick. If Claudio came out every week dressed up as a rugby player with a rugby stick, that would be a different story. It would be like a modern-day adaptation of the Goon, who used to come out with a hockey stick on fake boots. You know, fake skates, I should say. But, you know, he comes out and he looks fine, and the backstory is he used to play rugby. So what? Did you really expect that he was going to come out and they were going to talk about what a great wrestler he was in Ring of Honor? Of course not. So that doesn't bother me as much as it seems to bother some other people. I'm just happy the guy's finally on TV. I'm not going to complain. I'm happy. I'm really genuinely happy for the guy. He looked good. I think there's big things in his future, just like his former tag team partner. Speaking of which, Thursday night, FCW taped TV that will air down in Florida. I believe it airs on May 13th. This particular episode of FCW Wrestling has a match between Cassius Ohno and Antonio Cesaro, that being the former Chris Hero and Claudio Castagnoli. They had a one-on-one match, and a little bit of a spoiler here. Hero beat Claudio by DQ after Hero nailed the referee with a roaring elbow. Claudio, I guess, pulled the referee into harm's way. I must see this match after it airs, once it makes its way onto YouTube. So if I don't find it first, if somebody else does, please post it on my Facebook page, because I am very excited to see this Cassius Ohno Antonio Cesaro match. Call him whatever you want. It's Hero, it's Claudio, it's FCW, and I want to see that match. And by the way, just on that note, a quick note, for people who post links to YouTube videos on my page, that's fine every now and then if there's a video worth posting, but some people will post different parts to the same show. They'll post like 3 or 4 videos in a row. That is the quickest way to get banned from the page. So when you're posting links like that, first of all, don't do it all the time. And second of all, just be mindful when you're posting constantly, because you know, I don't want my wall cluttered with just links to nothing but YouTube videos. So just be mindful of that going forward. Just a friendly note. One of the big stories of the week was the suspension of Rey Mysterio, who fell victim for the second time to WWE's wellness policy. The announcement was made Thursday on WWE.com. The announcement said, in accordance with its talent wellness program, WWE has suspended Oscar Gutierrez, that being Rey Mysterio, for 60 days, effective Thursday, April 26th, for his second violation of the company's policy. And they did not mention what he failed for. The news hasn't gotten out. I would imagine at some point there'll be some report about what it might have been. Nobody has heard from Mysterio. He has not made any public comment about this. I do know the first time that Rey got suspended, I think there was an issue with him in WWE. He contested that it was a painkiller. I could be wrong about this, but something that he may have been prescribed for an injury. and he was not happy at all that WWE made his name public and put it on the website, because again, it tarnishes his reputation. It makes him look like a druggie, and I can understand him being upset about that if he had a legitimate excuse. So I can only imagine, now that his name has been posted up there for a second time, I can only think that Ray is probably not very happy about that. But I have no idea what it's for. I can venture a guess, which is just a complete guess on my part. You know, he has been recovering from knee surgery now for a couple of months, and perhaps it was a medication, a painkiller or something that he was prescribed that was not cleared with WWE and was on the banned list, and he got popped. That's the only thing I could think of, but maybe it's something else. You know, maybe it's something more sinister. I don't know. Nobody seems to be talking so far, but how this affects him going forward, I guess we'll find out. It certainly puts him in an elite class as far as two-time offenders of the wellness policy. The other superstars that we know of, anyway, who have gotten two strikes against them for wellness violations, Evan Bourne is probably the most recent example of that. William Regal has two strikes against him, which, you know, at one point, William Regal was I don't want to say being groomed for the world title, because I don't know that, but he was getting a huge push in WWE. He was the general manager and all of that. And that second strike against him when he messed up, it put him in a situation where WWE, it's very difficult for the company to put their faith and trust in you when you betray it like that. Regal has never gotten the same level of push since. He's still with the company. He's still very entertaining. He could be doing so much more. But as far as him getting a run at the world title or anything, I think one of the reasons why WWE doesn't seem to ever entertain the idea of putting Regal in a spot like that is because he's burned them before. And I think he knows it. So Regal is on that list. Booker T is another one. He has two strikes against him. Jeff Hardy has two strikes against him, which he would still have if he ever decided to come back to WWE. It doesn't just wash away. According to the actual policy, this is what it says with respect to this. And I looked it up. So this is what it says in so many words. Any WWE talent who tests positive, this would be for a second failure, will be tested a minimum of 12 times during the period of a year. A third violation would result in termination, in which case that talent would be prohibited from returning to the company for at least 1 year. Before a possible return, that person must test negative for all prohibited substances under the policy during a pre-contract screening. If they pass the pre-contract screening and are approved, they must then undergo a mandatory unannounced drug testing for at least 1 year after the execution of the new contract. And again, for those who have asked, because I've gotten some emails about this, that talent, if they ever do come back to the company, would return with two strikes still on their record. They would not start over from scratch, which is good to know, because WWE was kind of forced to clarify that. I forgot who the wrestler was that got suspended, but they got some heat, and WWE came out with a statement. This was way back when, and they basically, this is what they said, okay? They explained it, that the person, when they come back to the company, if they had two strikes, it's not a situation where they start from scratch, no strikes. They still have those two strikes against them, which means, again, one infraction, one violation, one failure, and they're terminated all over again. So, you know, for Rey Mysterio, one of the biggest stars in the company, former, you know, world champion and all that, it's kind of a big deal that this guy now has two strikes against him. And if something happens, Rey Mysterio could very well become the first wrestler of his caliber, because of a wellness violation, to just outright be fired by WWE. That is what he has now put himself, that's the position he's now put himself in. Which begs the question, would WWE dare to put him back in the main event going forward? Would they put their world title on this guy? Would they put him in a high-profile match at WrestleMania? Can he be trusted? What's his excuse this time? We don't know. It's certainly not out of the realm of possibility. He failed twice. He could fail a third time. So it's going to be very interesting, I think, going forward to see what they do with him. Now, originally he was expecting to be back, I think, either in late May or sometime in June. 60 days means that, at the earliest, I don't think he would be able to come back until the very end of June, probably early July. So anybody expecting or hoping to see Rey Mysterio before that, it will not happen now. Although, interestingly enough, that would put Rey's potential comeback right around the same time, I believe, that Sin Cara is supposed to come back. And there had been rumblings that, had these two guys not got injured, there was going to be a Rey Mysterio-Sin Cara match at WrestleMania. They had the whole idea of trying to set a new record and having people wear masks at the stadium, and then, of course, none of that happened. So now all of a sudden with Ray's return pushed back, if Sin Cara is on schedule, I remember hearing that July would be around the time he would come back, which, by the way, is also the targeted time frame for Wade Barrett to come back. But for Ray and Sin Cara to come back at the same time is also kind of an interesting thing to keep an eye on there. We'll see if maybe WWE decides to take the two guys who have... Because I think Sin Cara also has failed for a wellness violation, although I think he only has one strike. But let's take the two guys that have failed and just put them in a feud together so that if anything happens, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't impact any of our major storylines. So we'll see what they do with these guys when they come back. TNA made kind of a major announcement this week. TNA and Spike TV announced that on Friday afternoon, which, as a PR person, Friday is an odd time to put out an announcement or a press release, really, for anything, especially Friday afternoon. That's usually, even the White House does that, you know, where they have what they call like a news dump, because that's one of those times where news can fall under the radar at the very end of the week. People really aren't paying attention. It's, you know, when you send a press release, if you have a major announcement to make, typically, as I've done before, you put an announcement out first thing on Monday morning. And if not on Monday, if Monday maybe is a little too busy, then you do it Tuesday morning. You usually don't put an announcement out on late in the day on Friday unless it's bad news. So maybe Spike considers this bad news, even though they tried to paint this out as something positive. I don't know. But they did make the announcement that starting on May 31st, Impact Wrestling will move to 8 p.m. on Thursday nights. They're going to be moving to an hour earlier, from 8 to 10 as opposed to 9 to 11. It put a press release out noting that the decision was made based on the idea that there would be a larger viewing audience, at 8 p.m. and less competition from sports programming at that time. That's not what backstage sources are saying or anything. This is what they actually said in the press release. They basically said, listen, we're going to get slaughtered if we don't move our show to be an hour earlier than it is right now. So that's basically why we made the move. Astounding that they would actually say that in the press release. But whatever, I mean, hey, at least they're being honest, because that is the reason. TNA has been very concerned about the NFL games that will be airing on Thursday starting this fall. On the NFL Network, they will be having, I believe, at 9 o'clock Eastern on Thursdays, a game, I believe, every week on the network. So this was a necessary move in a lot of ways for TNA, because they're going to face some very stiff competition from those NFL games. By moving the show up 1 hour, they may be able to avoid complete annihilation, at least for the first hour. The second hour will probably still be annihilated, but the first hour, at least, they can get a head start before the NFL game begins. So if they were going to make this change, it has to be done now, so they have time to establish the new time slot with viewers. You can't do it a couple of weeks before the first NFL game or a month before. So if that's the idea here, I actually think it's a good move on TNA's part. I'm not sure if it was TNA or Spike, or if it was, you know, the two of them equally that came to this decision. But looking ahead, especially of late, Impact's ratings of late have not been good at all. In fact, I think the last two episodes of Impact have both done under a 1. You know, TNA usually does their requisite 1.0, 1.1. The last two shows, including that post-show after lockdown, one of their biggest pay-per-views of the year, which supposedly did pretty well by TNA standards, both of those shows, including the show after lockdown, did under a 1. It did like a 0.96 or something like that. That's not good. That is not good at all. So the timing may actually be perfect. This is not like moving to Monday nights to go head-to-head with WWE, which was, in hindsight, a boneheaded move, even though I think at the time I argued that it's worth taking that chance, even though they got killed and they were smart enough to go back to their old slot. This is not even on that level. You know, they're moving their show up 1 hour. Big deal. I think in the end, it'll help them. That doesn't mean that Impact's ratings are going to shoot up. It just means they're doing something to shield themselves from the impact of this monster called the NFL, which crushes all of its competition. Impact does not stand a chance against the NFL on Thursday night, so at least that first hour, they'll have a bit of a cushion where they won't have to go up against football. One other story here I want to get into before I get to the shout-outs. Kind of a horrible story, actually, involving Buff Bagwell, former WCW superstar and very briefly WWE superstar. He was involved in a very serious auto accident this week, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and TMZ.com, both of whom have covered this story at length. Bagwell was driving his Jeep earlier in the week. I don't remember which day, if it was Monday or Tuesday. and he lost control of the vehicle, which then struck a median and flipped over about 8 times. Supposedly, the vehicle flipped over about 8 or 9 times. And he was left with broken bones in his neck. I believe 2 broken bones in his neck. So here's a guy that's had neck problems before. He's had a broken neck before. And now he's got his neck broken again in 2 places. That's not good. He's got severe facial injuries, including a broken jaw that had to be wired shut. Supposedly, his jaw is going to be wired shut for at least 6 months. And he's got some other injuries as well. According to the police report, Bagwell phoned his wife right before the accident and told her that he was about to have a seizure, which begs the question, if he had enough time to call his wife to tell her that he was going to have a seizure, why didn't he pull the car over? I mean, we don't have all the details right now, so I'm not trying to bash the guy. I'm just saying, you read the police report and what they're saying happened here, and the wife has told the police, he called me right before to say he was going to, or he thought he was going to have a seizure. Obviously, he was on the road driving, and then the car flipped over several times. Something just doesn't make sense here, because you would think that, okay, he wants to call his wife, that's fine. And I can understand that, because if he has a seizure and, God forbid, something happens, even let's say he pulls the car over on the side of the road and then has a seizure and nobody knows, I mean, that could be a really bad situation. I mean, a really bad situation. So I get that aspect of it, but why he just didn't pull the car over, that part is what doesn't make any sense to me. Bagwell was transported to a hospital. He is currently sedated due to the extent of his injuries. So he has not regained consciousness. They have intentionally kept him sedated because his injuries are so severe. And it's just a really bad situation right now. He's not out of the woods. He is in rough shape, to say the least. And I don't really know what else to say other than, you know, thoughts are with the guy. I've never really been a big Buff Bagwell fan, I'll be honest, but that doesn't mean I want to see the guy, you know, die or, God forbid, be paralyzed. There's a lot of concern right now with the broken neck, and he's sedated, so he's out cold. We don't know whether or not he can move his extremities. He may well be paralyzed. We don't know that, but that's a concern that some people supposedly have. And here's a guy, remember, he got hurt in WCW back in 1998 on an episode of Thunder. He took a botched bulldog off the top rope by Scott Steiner, or rather, I'm sorry, by Rick Steiner. And the way it happened, it looked like it was botched by Rick, but I'm not quite sure. But basically, when Rick came down for the bulldog, he didn't quite grab hold of Buff. So down went Rick Steiner, and Buff, his response was almost delayed, where he didn't go down right away when Rick came down for the move. So there was like a 2 or 3 second delay, and when Bagwell went down, his head kind of jammed, I think into the back of Rick's shoulder or something. And anyway, it was a pretty severe injury, and he has had addictions to pain pills before. This has been well documented. In fact, I think there was a documentary, it might have been on HBO, one of the HBO Real Sports or something, did a segment a couple of years ago on Buff. And he talked about being hooked on tons of pills. So here's a guy that's had issues with drugs and painkillers, and to my knowledge is still dealing with the effects of that first broken neck. Now he's broken his neck again. Think about that. Think if he gets through all of this and he can walk again and live a relatively normal life, if his neck was in such bad shape that he had to rely on pain pills before, he's got a lot of issues going forward. So I would say if you're the kind of person who likes to pray for people, he could probably use some prayers right now because he is in rough shape. So any updates on the condition of Buff Bagwell? Anything serious happens, I'll probably talk about it on the next show. But, not a good situation at all. Speaking of the next show, not sure how many of you are aware of this, but next week will mark the 10-year anniversary of the transformation of the World Wrestling Federation, WWF, to WWE. It was 10 years ago next week that it officially changed. And I'm going to talk about that next week, the change from WWF to WWE, and how the company has changed over the last 10 years since the name change. So I'll talk about that on Sound Off 217 next week. Just wanted to make a note of that. Let's get to some of the shout-outs here that you guys have sent in to me. Got a couple here to get to, and then we'll tackle a few mailbag questions. I've already gone too long. Brass Tacks. Got to mention my buddy Brass Tacks. He, of course, is the one responsible for the awesome Sound Off intro each week that I know some of you are not too fond of, but I really don't care. It's not everybody's cup of tea, but I like it. I think it's a fun intro for the show, and I appreciate his hard work on that and all the other things. He's been a big fan, a big supporter of the show, and so I wanted to give him a birthday shout-out. Brass Tacks, Mr. Producer himself, celebrating a birthday coming up on May the 1st. So happy birthday, Brass Tacks, and thank you for all of your support. Alexander writes in, says, I was hoping to get a shout-out. My birthday is, or was, April 27th, and what a better time to celebrate a birthday than a Friday night. I say amen to that. He says, I also want to take this time to congratulate you for your amazing job on the podcast that, in my opinion, is the best wrestling podcast in the world. So, you see, sucking up is certainly one way to get a shout-out on this show, but I will assume that you are being sincere so I don't hurt my own feelings. So thank you, Alexander, and happy birthday. Tyler Smuskowitz from Louisville, Kentucky writes in. He is a member of the Fantastic Four and posted a review for the show in iTunes, which is the easiest way to get a shout-out on this show. He also wanted to see if I might devote some time to the subject of Jeff Hardy. Tyler feels that if Jeff does have his act together, he no doubt deserves the Hall of Fame. He deserves, or rather, he devotes himself to the company and to his fans. Well, my thoughts on Jeff Hardy is this. Forget the Hall of Fame. I think Jeff Hardy one day will go into the Hall of Fame. Not anytime soon. Certainly not while he's under contract to TNA, but he's still an active wrestler, and so I'm not even concerned about that. The bigger question is, would Jeff Hardy come back to WWE? It's not a question of WWE taking him back. They would take Jeff Hardy back in a heartbeat. I've talked about that before. He proved himself to be a genuine draw and sold a lot of merchandise. And for that reason alone, they would love to have him back, even though he's one of these guys that has two strikes against him. The question is, will he ever come back? And that's ultimately a decision that Jeff Hardy has to make. He seems to be rather content in TNA right now. He does not have as hectic a schedule as he would have in WWE or other stresses and pressures he may have there that he doesn't have down in TNA. So I think he's pretty content where he is now. I do think he'll be back in WWE one day. I can't tell you when that's going to be. I just find it hard to believe that we've seen Jeff Hardy's last match in a WWE ring. I think one day he will be back. Although I don't think anytime soon, unless his contract is coming up, and I don't believe it is. But he seems to have gotten his act together in that we haven't heard any horror stories from him. You know, we haven't heard about him showing up late to the events. We haven't had a repeat of what happened at Victory Road that one time where he came out, you know, all fucked up for his match with Sting. And that was just a complete embarrassment for wrestling in general. More so TNA, though, for allowing it to happen. We haven't heard anything like that. Nothing like that has happened since then. He's been a model citizen. He's been a model employee. He shows up. He does his job. He wrestles. Has some pretty good matches. And he seems to have his head on straight for the time being. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Forget the fans. It's a good thing for himself. It's a good thing for his family. He's got a young kid. I'm happy for him. You know, I certainly am happy for him. And hopefully I didn't just jinx him. And we'll hear that, Jeff Hardy did something stupid next week. It's good to see. It's good that we haven't heard anything about Jeff, which is a good thing. And hopefully going forward, that will continue. And if he wants to come back to WWE, I'm sure they would welcome him back with open arms. And when that is, like I said, who knows? But, Jeff Hardy is a guy who I had a problem with at one time because it was just one thing after another. And if he has gotten his act together, I give him kudos. I think that's a wonderful thing. I want to give one last shout-out here to Jerry Martinez, who also left a review in iTunes. He said the sound-off is always the highlight of his Sundays. He's a dedicated listener, enjoys the occasional rant, says the show is the best thing to happen since sliced bread. I say it's the best thing to happen since sliced bread number 2. It's a pretty cool move. So thank you to Jerry again. If you want to leave a review in iTunes and let me know about it, you will get a shout-out on the show. I very much appreciate it. I think we're up to 65 now. 65 reviews. So maybe you can be number 66. You go into iTunes, type in the name of the show, and leave a review. So let's get into a couple of questions here, and then we'll wrap this up. Jacob writes in and wants to know what I thought of Sweet and Sour Larry Sweeney as a manager. I thought he was great. I thought he was so great that it's a crime that he never got a spot on a main roster in TNA or WWE, especially in WWE. I mean, Larry Sweeney, in a lot of ways, there's only one Bobby Heenan, but he reminded me a lot of Bobby Heenan, just in terms of the way he presented himself and the fact that in Ring of Honor, for example, he represented a whole bunch of different guys. And so in WWE, he could have been a modern-day adaptation of Bobby Heenan in that Heenan was always well-known for managing, I think, almost everybody in the roster. I literally think that at one point Bobby Heenan managed everybody except Hulk Hogan. Like, all the heels. He managed, I mean, Andre the Giant, Big John Studd, Ravishing Rick Rude, King Kong Bundy, the Brain Busters, Brooklyn Brawler. Well, it can't all be winners. Terry Taylor at one point. I think that was before he became the Red Rooster. But so many different guys. And Sweeney could have been that guy in WWE now. You know, you don't need Abraham Washington walking around handing people his card. Hey, you know, if you need an agent, let me know. Sweeney could have been that guy. And he was a very entertaining, seemed to be always very wound up, you know, very much in character. But the fact that he took his own life and is no longer with us is it's a damn shame, because I think he really could have been so much bigger than he was. This next question comes from another Jacob, a different one, Jacob Rail from Wichita, Kansas. Dear Solomoster, what is the worst gimmick that a superstar has ever had? Also, the best gimmick a superstar has ever had in any promotion. Been listening since the episodes in the 170s, and my favorite ones are the infamous Michael Jackson episode and Sound Off 212. So thank you to Jacob. Worst wrestling gimmick, I think, is an impossible question to answer. There have been so many goddamn awful wrestling gimmicks. Some are hilariously bad, some are just bad, that it's impossible to narrow down to just one. You could always mention the Shockmaster. Any discussion about horrible wrestling gimmicks has to include the Shockmaster. This guy coming out with a glittered Star Wars helmet that falls off his head when he trips and falls flat on his face. Amazing. And I wouldn't believe it if I didn't actually see the footage for myself. This really did happen, and they thought that this would be a good idea. So the Shockmaster has to be one. You've got the mid-90s, like around 95 in WWF, was just torturous. Absolutely torturous. You had, you know, Duke the Dumpster Drosy, who was a garbage man. You had T.L. Hopper, who was a plumber. You had Isaac Yankum, the evil dentist. You had the Goon, who I mentioned earlier, who was a hockey player by day, I guess, and a wrestler by night. You had, who else did you have? There was one other one. Actually, you know what? Alex the Pug Porto was not a bad gimmick. His gimmick was that he was a, I guess, like an amateur wrestler. But they just had this influx of guys at that time with these ridiculous characters. It was just completely, unbelievably bad. So you had all those, and WCW also, for God's sake, WCW had their share of awful gimmicks as well. This, mind you, the company that at different points had both RoboCop and Chucky the Killer Talking Doll on their television show as actual characters that the announcers had to take seriously. Think about that. So those are some pretty shitty gimmicks from over the years. And hey, you can make an argument about even Lord Tensai as a bad gimmick. By no means the worst gimmick of all time, but there's an example of clearly a gimmick from another age, you know, given to a current guy that just isn't working. Umaga, you know, this raving savage. That was a gimmick right out of the 80s. But it doesn't come anywhere close to the, you know, the dumpsters and the T.L. Hoppers and all those terrible characters. One, I have to make a quick comment about this. There are, you know, websites that have their own lists of bad wrestling gimmicks, and they'll mention other ones like, you know, Repo Man and IRS. And IRS was a pretty stupid gimmick. I mean, he'd made the most of it, yes, but, you know, here's a guy who was on television once before as Mike Rotundo, and now he comes back as an evil tax man. At least if you're going to do a gimmick like that, do it with somebody new. Don't do it with somebody that you've already established, even if it was years ago, on your own TV show as being somebody else. So that was kind of dumb. But one gimmick that I see making some people's lists every now and then is the Dan Spivey gimmick from WWF. Again, I think it was in 95, ironically enough. Waylon Mercy, a character that, if I remember correctly, was modeled pretty closely after the, was it De Niro in the movie Cape Fear? That character gets a lot of flack that I don't think it really deserves. And the character ended because Spivey was injured. He was powerbombed by Kevin Nash when he was Diesel. And that I think that was it at that point for him. He suffered a career-ending injury, and that was the end of Waylon Mercy. But I think that character had a lot of potential. It was a very unnerving character. If you go back and look at Waylon Mercy promos and even his theme music, you know, when it would start out, you know what I mean? Actually, no, that wasn't the theme music. His theme music would start out, I think, with him saying, you know, lives are going to be in Waylon Mercy's hands. And it was just, the whole package was just unique in a lot of ways. So I actually think that the Waylon Mercy character was not a bad gimmick. I think it had a lot of potential, and then he got hurt, and it didn't go anywhere. Plus, Spivey at that point was already at the end of his rope. You know, he physically, he was not what he used to be. And I mentioned the Waylon Mercy character, interestingly enough. I just saw on YouTube yesterday a promo for Husky Harris's new character down in Florida Championship Wrestling. He's playing this new character by the name of Bray Wyatt, a Southern boy from Lafayette, Louisiana. He is managed, ironically enough, I don't know if he's a manager or a bodyguard, but in the background you see Eli Cottonwood, who at least stood there and kept his mouth shut. He is a big guy. That might be the best role for him. Hopefully they'll give him a new name, too. But I have to mention this because the Bray Wyatt character that Husky Harris is now portraying is very, very similar to the Waylon Mercy character, in that I also think that character borrows from the movie Cape Fear. And I think that Husky Harris in that promo, that minute-long promo, minute and 30 seconds, whatever it was, did a hell of a job. If you have not seen it, you can find it. You can go on YouTube and type in Bray Wyatt promo. It'll come right up. I thought he did an awesome job with that promo. Again, it's taking a guy that's already been established and giving him a character, because he talks about growing up in Lafayette, Louisiana, which of course he didn't. He talks about his daddy burning and dying, which is funny because IRS, who I mentioned before, Mike Rotundo, is his father. So you'll find comments on YouTube of people saying, oh, I didn't know that IRS was dead, and stupid stuff like that. But in spite of that, I thought the promo was great, and I think that that character has a lot of potential on TV. I wanted to see the Bray Wyatt character on Raw when I watched that promo. I thought, why isn't he on TV now? You know, he looks like he lost a lot of weight. I was always very disappointed when they took Husky Harris off TV, because in part he was so big. He was like a tank with legs. I mean, he was quick. He was brutal. He was stiff. He was everything that people on the WWE roster are not, that made him unique. And he did lose some weight, but I actually like the character. If you haven't seen the video, check it out. Anyway, I went completely off subject. The best gimmick. To me, there's only one answer to this question. The best gimmick in the history of wrestling in any promotion is The Undertaker. It was the brainchild of Vince McMahon. He, you know, gave the gimmick to Mark Calloway, who was Mean Mark in WCW. He came over, he became The Undertaker, and the rest is history. It is the single greatest gimmick in the history of pro wrestling, even if you're not an Undertaker fan. It depends on what your definition is of the best gimmick. If part of that is the longevity of the gimmick, the success of the gimmick, the drawing value of the gimmick, I don't see how you can't vote for The Undertaker. The character has been around since 1990. Even now, if he's wrestling once a year, it doesn't matter. He's still active. He is still active and one of the top performers, the main event headline guys in the company, in 2012. That is amazing. That is amazing longevity in wrestling, especially in WWE. And from the very beginning, he was a top star. I mean, a year after he made his debut, he beat Hulk Hogan for the championship at Survivor Series. That was a big deal. And he went on to have all these big matches and feuds with everybody from Jake Roberts and, you know, you go down the list, Yokozuna and Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Triple H, The Rock, Steve Austin, Kane, Undertaker, Big Show, Sid, everybody in between, Mankind. That, in my opinion, may be his greatest feud of all time with Mick Foley as Mankind and the wars that those two guys had. And a lot of the character is over the top in its presentation, and, you know, he has magical powers and this and that and the urn. Yes, it's very over the top, but he made it work. And it's to the point now where I don't know that you can ever even conceive of a gimmick, you know, coming up with a character for somebody and having it be as successful as the Undertaker character has been for Mark Calloway. So I think the answer to that is a hell of a lot easier than the answer to the worst gimmick, because the worst gimmick, you have a multitude of different options. The best gimmick, there really is only one option. Unless you want to throw Kane into the equation. You can make that argument that Kane is also way up there with The Undertaker. Maybe not quite there, because The Undertaker had so many years prior to Kane's arrival that he was successful in the company. And who knows? I mean, if The Undertaker does call it quits in another year or two and Kane sticks around, Kane may outlast him at some point. It's not out of the realm of possibility, even though I don't think it'll happen, but you know, Kane could end up outlasting his brother on the WWE roster. So who knows? Kane probably would be the closest one because, you know, again, he's got the mask and he was the brother who was, you know, scarred as a child, even though he really wasn't. It's, you know, a classic wrestling gimmick, but it worked. It worked for Kane. Now, I think part of that was the connection to the Undertaker character. I don't know that that character necessarily would have worked without that connection. Maybe it would have. I've always been a big Kane fan. The original Kane, to me, is one of the most menacing-looking monsters in the history of the company. I thought the presentation of the Kane character was just phenomenal, from the mask to the outfit to the music, the pyro and the posts in each corner. It's just really great stuff. So Kane, yes, you can make the argument that Kane is right behind The Undertaker, but to me, The Undertaker still takes the cake as being the greatest gimmick that any promoter has ever come up with, and then in execution, it's been the most successful. I mean, I dare anybody to find me another one that's been more successful than Undertaker as far as an actual character that they create, an over-the-top character like, a Walking Dead Man. I mean, whoever would have thought that a Walking Dead Man character in pro wrestling would actually work? And here we are now, 22 years or so after The Undertaker debuted? It's just amazing. Chris from Leeds, England writes in something that has annoyed me for quite a while now. Why is it that in 95% of tag team matches, someone will have a match clearly won and be in a pinning position, but the partner, I guess of the other person, always comes in and performs a stomp, for example, and the pin just stops? Just because the other tag team partner has hit the opponent, the pinfall suddenly doesn't count? I know that they have to tell a story during the match, but surely if you were going to win a match, you would take the stomp and continue to pin your opponent. It's not a matter of that. It's interference. If I'm in a tag team match, if me and Noah Mark are tag team partners, and you know that in that team I'm the Shawn Michaels and he's the Marty Jannetty. You just know that. But let's just say we're tag team partners, okay? And our opponents are the Usos. Not the Usos. Let's say our opponents are Primo and Epico, okay? Easy win for us. And I'm in the ring with a pin on Primo. So Epico comes in and stomps on the back of my head. Now, true, I'm still covering Primo. But the minute that Epico enters the ring and strikes me is interference. He probably should just be disqualified. But a lot of the referees don't do that, obviously. But it's the act of actually attacking the other opponent. It's interference. That's how I look at it anyway. So, yeah, it's kind of you can make the argument it's a dumb thing. It's one of those wrestling things. But at least there is kind of an explanation for it. It's interference. It's the referee's obligation at that point, if he doesn't disqualify you, to stop the count, it breaks the fall, and remove you from the ring. It's interference. Last question here comes from James. Just wanted to point out how stupid it was that Sheamus got fined for $500,000 for kicking a referee, but The Undertaker chokeslammed Charles Robinson and put his Hell's Gate finisher on Shawn Michaels, who was the referee for his match at WrestleMania, and didn't get fined at all. Do you think WWE forgot, or do you think they just don't care? It's a very good point. I'm sure they just completely forgot. That's my honest opinion. I just don't think they pay attention to things like that. They probably just forgot. You would think that in storyline, if John Laurinaitis wanted The Undertaker to stick around for more than just one match a year, he would fine him like $1 million and put his pinky to his mouth when he says that, by the way. But he would fine Undertaker like a ridiculous amount of money so that Undertaker, the storyline could be, is not destitute, but he needs to make money because he just got fined $1 million. And so Undertaker has no choice but to come back and wrestle more than one match a year. See, if I'm John Laurinaitis, that's how I get The Undertaker to come back. But this is all way above WWE's way of thinking. But it's a very good point. I really hadn't thought about that. Undertaker did beat up some referees at WrestleMania and seemingly faced no repercussions for it. So there you go. He also wanted to know, James did, what I thought of the Undertaker Edge match at WrestleMania 24. I will admit, I don't remember too much about the match. I have not gone back and watched it since the first time in 2008. I don't remember thinking it was a great match. There was just something about that match. It didn't feel like a WrestleMania main event to me. It just didn't. But the one thing I do remember from that match, as well I'm sure many of you do, is what will live on in infamy forever. I think Undertaker nailed Edge with the tombstone, went for the pin. There was no referee. And so here comes, ironically, the same referee that Undertaker beat up at this year's WrestleMania, Lil Nate, referee Charles Robinson, who was dispatched from the back to come down to the ringside area to count the fall. But WrestleMania that year was in Orlando. At the, the Orange Bowl. And that was a long aisle way down to the ring. I mean, really long. And they had the great camera shot. And there are people that have done animated GIFs and videos on YouTube set to funny music. There's Charles Robinson absolutely running his heart out. He is darting down to the ring as fast as his legs can carry him, which is not nearly fast enough. It's just comical watching him. It took 25 seconds for him to run down from the back all the way to the ring, and he finally makes it. And it was only a two count. I think it was a near fall. But that, to me, is the one moment from that match that I remember, was Charles Robinson's amazing run from the back down to the ring at WrestleMania 24. I think somebody did a video on YouTube, I don't know if it's still up, of him running down to the ring set to the Ultimate Warrior's music. It's like the greatest thing I've ever seen. If you could find that video, you will laugh. So that, to me, is really the only thing I remember of any significance from that match, other than the fact that The Undertaker did win the championship. That's kind of important. That's going to do it for the mailbag this week. If you have questions to submit, email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. That is the email address for anything and everything. Otherwise, I probably won't see it. So thesolemonster@gmail.com for any questions, shout-outs, things of that nature. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. Again, I will be posting information on Monday, most likely, about the call-in number and whatever else you may need to know about SE Scoops Live. So follow me on Twitter and friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/thesolemonster. I'll have all the information and links and all that stuff up there. Subscribe to the show in iTunes and leave a review if you would be so kind. And again, don't forget, SE Scoops Live, for at least one night only, is back this Monday, April 30th, 8 o'clock Eastern Time, 1 hour before Monday Night Raw, not after, before Monday Night Raw. We will be on the air discussing Extreme Rules, previewing Raw for that night. We'll take your calls. If you want to call into the show live, you will have the opportunity to do so. I'm sure that hour is just going to breeze by, assuming we don't have any technical issues that eat up the first 10 minutes of the show. So I don't know how many calls we'll actually be able to get to. We'll get to a couple at least. So if you want to try calling in, by all means, you can certainly do so. So it should be a good time. Hopefully, you'll join us and everybody will have some fun before Raw this Monday night. So next week, back with episode 217. Again, I'll talk a little bit more about the transition from WWF to WWE as we celebrate 10 years. I can't believe it's been a decade since that happened, but it has been. We got the F out 10 years ago. I think we ought to get the F back in. What do you think? We'll talk about that next week and a whole lot more. So until then, be well, stay safe, have a great week, and as always, thank you for your support of the show. Without you guys, there is no Sound Off. So thank you, and we will see you next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.